Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. My name is Ray. This is Anthony. And tonight we're going to be discussing the ultra-viral interview that Tucker Carlson did with Ted Cruz. It gets on all sorts of realms. And it's definitely very self-reflective for me because, you know, I voted for Ted Cruz in 2016. And man, has he fallen off hard. And I can't think of a single politician that's fallen off more since 2016 than Ted Cruz has. So this is part of that, because he has definitely become a neocon, and you hate to see that. And Tucker Carlson has his ups and downs, has his issues that he's really solid on, and he does a Socratic method interview that just makes Ted Cruz, in my opinion, come across as very foolish. So there's a lot going on right now. You could say that dispensationalists are frothing at the mouth over the affairs of the Middle East right now. So we're going to dive into that. Anthony, I don't know if you have any opening words on the interview and stuff like that.
I mean, it's just kind of amazing that we go from like having Gay Pride Month in June to June being the Gay Pride Month for the globalist American empire. So we just traded one gay for another. And Ted Cruz is, you know, choosing the side of gay pride in this case.
Well, here's the thing about Ted Cruz. He supports gay rights, so he's not solid. Yeah, he's gay affirming, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Ted Cruz affirms homosexuality, and this especially came out when he opposed the Uganda law.
That was about a year ago, and that was also in June. And no U.S. senator cares more about Ugandan homosexuals than Ted Cruz.
Yeah, so it's absolutely insane, but he claims to be a Christian. There's no reason, if you're a Christian, to support the legalization of sodomy. Like, there's no biblical argument to make for that. It's just rooted in it's just liberalism. And what we're seeing is that Ted Cruz is really bad at theology, despite the fact that his father was a pastor, you know, very famous pastor at that. So I just kind of wonder, it's like, one of the big lines that we're going to cover tonight is the fact that he doesn't know the part of the Bible that he's basing his entire belief system off of. So I just thought that was interesting. So, but obviously the big overarching discussion is between Iran and the Israel-Iran war, which has popped off over the last 10 days or so, however long it's actually been. And, you know, as far as the Trump factor goes, I wrote an article on for Monday, I believe. And the big idea was that Trump responds to the pressure of the base. So the 2024 election was just the beginning of the fight. And when Trump wanted to relent on the crackdown and the deportations, especially at the agriculture and hospitality sectors
and
of
keep
the economy.
In mind, let me just say that inside the halls of Congress, Big Ag was lobbying hard. Like, you had a lot of lobbying pressure happening in D.C. that preceded the announcement from Trump. So they were lobbying and pushing hard in Congress.
Yeah,
that's why that change happened.
Yeah, so they lobby hard for that. And we made our voices a lot louder than they did, evidently, in Trump reverse course. So that's good. that to me is a positive development. So with that said, on the keeping America out of another Middle Eastern war will require very loud voices. And Tucker Carlson's definitely doing his part, but you got a lot of Christian media, Babylon Bee, Christian Post, you know, they're fanning the flames of war.
Fox News.
Fox News. I mean, they're not really Christian, but yeah. But they're definitely fanning the flames of war, and you hate to see that. So I think this is, you know, when people lament Israel being a top 10 issue, no, Israel has to be a top 10 issue, not because we want them to be, but because not getting dragged into another Middle Eastern war is a top 10 issue. It's just become that. America should really have no temptation or desire, whether internal or external, to get involved in another Middle Eastern war.
I mean, literally, there's no geostrategic interest in the Middle East other than the flow of oil and the security of the trade routes, which would be the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And the Strait of Hormuz. Other than that, there is no geopolitical interest in supporting Israel apart from people just want to. And obviously, Zionism, dispensationalism, and certain other ideologies support this. And from a geopolitical chessboard, Israel is more of a liability than it is an asset.
Well, yeah, the British and the French found that out the hard way when they wanted to invade Egypt via coordination with Israel. They used Israel as Israel and Egypt as a pretext to invade Egypt, and that completely backfired in their face because they were about to turn the entire Muslim world into the hands of the communists during the Cold War. So, yeah, Israel's a kind of a huge liability for certain policy ambitions. And thus, you know, the British Empire, that was the last gasp of the British Empire. And also the French, that was like their last gasp of testosterone. So, yeah, I don't think good things happen when you ally with Israel and stuff like that. I don't think good things happen. And that's one of the things that you get into when you talk about Genesis 12. Well, what are the blessings? I still have not gotten an answer on that question, which I guess we'll get into in a little bit. So I think we're ready to get into this. I think there is one other part of this interview that I want to play other than the theological part, and it comes slightly before that. It is the part about AIPAC, and I just think it's very interesting because Ted Cruz is really trying to explain, you know, where exactly his views for Israel come from. So he's really, he feels the need to explain.
No, he basically is trying to play the card that, oh, they don't come from AIPAC. You know, I do it willingly.
And he really goes hard to the paint to defend defend AIPAC from the accusation that they should be registered as a foreign lobby. So this, I thought this part was, you could say, borderline disgraceful on the part of Ted Cruz. So let me know when I'm shared screen here. So this is Ted Cruz. This is the first clip I want to play. It's only about two minutes at most, I think. So here we go.
Taking money from the Israel.
From AIPAC.
So AIPAC raises a lot of money for me, but it's actually a misnomer because the people who raise money are individuals. Right. So it's not the PAC itself, but they're individual members who believe in the American-Israeli friendship and relationship.
Is AIPAC a foreign lobby?
No, it's an American lobby. It's the AIPAC stands for the America-Israeli Political Action
Committee. What does it lobby for?
So, to be honest, not a whole lot effectively. Listen, I came into Congress 13 years ago,
yes,
with the stated intention of being the leading defender of Israel in the United States Senate.
Great.
And I've worked every day to do that. AIPAC, I wish were much more effective. Like, They're folks online who are in the fever swamp of terrified of AIPAC. And AIPAC...
I'm not terrified of AIPAC at all. You're the one who seems a little uncomfortable when I'm asking.
No, not uncomfortable at all.
I'm just asking what AIPAC does. My understanding, having known a lot of people who work at AIPAC, is that it lobbies on behalf of the Israeli government.
Wrong.
Oh, okay.
It's...
America has...
That's the part that I wanted to share specifically. Ted Cruz really goes hard defending AIPAC and the idea that they are not some sort of... He's basically saying they're not part of a foreign government's plan to influence the United States, that they don't coordinate on behalf of the Israeli government. So I don't really believe Ted Cruz. I do agree with both of them that... Yeah, I think their influence is a little bit overstated because you don't necessarily need AIPAC when you got John Hagee and his theology very much permeating a lot of politically active-minded believers.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a large financial angle. I mean, I guess he kind of alludes to the fact that AIPAC is not just the donors or the organization itself, but it's also the donor class that it gives you access to. So even if, you know, AIPAC tracker on Twitter might say that, I think they say that Ted Cruz has received like $1.8 million from AIPAC, but it's more than that when you include the fact that it gives him access to donors that he might not have gotten without AIPAC endorsement. So there is a patronage angle to it. But I mean, yeah, the whole idea that they're not, you know, coordinating with the foreign government. They just want us to have a great relationship with them, which always ends up with us doing their bidding and giving them whatever they want with very little pushback.
Yeah, so there's a lot.
I mean, I guess that's not, you know, officially coordinating or officially being stooges for, but it's kind of the same thing, all, you know, just with a different coat of paint on it.
Yeah, what's interesting in this interview is Tucker Carlson does not get into any conspiracies. He doesn't even bring up, say, the USS Liberty that I'm aware of. Like, he doesn't go into anything that might be considered a trope. He's just really asking Ted Cruz questions.
He kind of only alludes to, like, the 9/11 conspiracy, but he doesn't even press into that because he has entertained that before.
Oh, yeah, he had a pretty solid interview with the guy, with a former congressman who opposed the Patriot Act, so... that was a very interesting interview on the 9/11 and unanswered questions, I guess you could say, from that, because he talked about how Osama bin Laden was hiding in Iran and the American government didn't go after him and didn't pursue him. And so that was a pretty interesting interview. Maybe the angle on that was, you know, that might have been an intelligence asset or something like that. Who knows? But anyway, Tucker Carlson, he doesn't go into territory that, you know, is terminally online like, you know, I might. So all he does is say, you know, what does AIPAC do, and just ask, and why aren't they registered as a foreign lobby when they clearly exist to serve an interest of a foreign government? Again, what American interest do they serve? And I see a lot of AIPAC ads on social media. None of them seem very pro-American.
I mean, he kind of says that they're not very effective, which I would say financially they probably are. And there's a reason the Democrats, and again, you know, there's still a Chuck Schumer wing of the Democrat Party, which is, you know, actively kind of aligned with AIPAC. I mean, similar to defense contractors, they tend to support the incumbents, especially those that vote for spending bills. And that's kind of what AIPAC would most likely just want, is they just want the money they just want the support to keep flowing, even if there's a little bit of more pro-Palestine rhetoric from the Democrats. But Obama was largely, like, I guess, neutered on the Israel thing. So to say that they lost, he'll make the argument that they lost power during the Obama years, but that's, they kind of stopped Obama from trying to, I guess, do a Palestinian two-state solution.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that they did defeat some of Obama's more anti-Zionist ambitions. but and
while turning him in, while turning the Democrat Party into a war party.
Yeah, so
they're pro Ukraine. They were pro Syria. Obama was, of course, notorious for using drones in the Middle East. So when you have a large shift in the Democrat Party that happened because of Barack Obama and during his presidency, where now the Republicans are the anti-war party, which is contrary to what they were, you know, in the John McCain era.
Yeah, in the, you know, late Cold War or even post-Cold War era, yeah, but the Republican Party traditionally has been more anti-war, you know, even going back to things like World War II. So what's pretty interesting, but you do make a great point about the Democrats becoming a pro-war party under the Obama administration. And Syria is very interesting in this interview, is when they bring up Syria, because, you know, I remember the Syrian civil war. I pay a lot of attention to the Ukraine-Russia war. But at the time, I paid a lot of attention to the Syrian civil war. And yeah, I don't know why the American foreign policy at the time was to assist Al-Qaeda. And one of the reasons that I like Ted Cruz, and also I found Donald Trump's foreign policy to be very good as well during the 2016 primaries, because they both opposed the intervention in Syria as well as Libya. And that's why I'm like very leery of someone like Marco Rubio ever becoming president, is because his judgment was so bad at the time on this issue. So, and Ted Cruz, what's just amazing and stunning to me, is that he has no self-reflection or self-accountability, I should say, in this entire interview.
Now, again, he'll say that he was against the Iraq war at the time. Again, I couldn't find any source at the time. Obviously, his political ascendancy is with the Tea Party movement and after that. So he was very critical of interventionist policies, including Iraq, including Syria, in, you know, 2012 to 2015, 16, and so forth. But I couldn't quite find at the time in 2003 where he was on the record saying he opposed George Bush's war. And certainly during Congress, he actually did approve of military use of, or the authorization of use of force in Iraq, ironically, as a senator. So that would, one might call that ironic for saying you oppose the Iraq war. However, his rhetoric in this interview kind of contradicts that, because he's very much, you know, ambivalent on whether he thinks Syria is better off post-Assad. And he did not say that in 2015 or 16 or 14 when Obama was president.
Yeah, I hate the idea that every time, you know, someone in American politics brings up a dictator of a foreign country, they have to be like, oh, he was such a bad guy. Or even though they have to qualify their statement, it's like, no, Assad was obviously the good guy in that conflict. Like, obviously, you're always going to deal with a lesser of two evils choices here on Earth. But he was obviously the good guy. Muammar Gaddafi was obviously the good guy in his conflict. And, you know, what he said came to fruition, that if you take him down, you'll be flooded with, you know, the blacks. I think he said the blacks. But there's a quote of him that's like that, that if you take him down, you know, all of Europe's going to be flooded with migrants. He was right about that. And Libya also, he was also a bad guy in the 80s or whatever, but he was basically pacified. There's no reason to oppose him. But the Obama administration, just like you alluded to before, they had a sudden change of heart. They embraced regime change everywhere. And my instincts at the time were, no, this is all Islamic terrorist. Why are we supporting them? Why are we supporting the Islam, you know, Middle Eastern countries becoming more invested in Islam? Why are we supporting that?
I mean, yeah, and it's funny. Tucker Carlson does not even allude to, like, the Clean Break Memo or all these, like, early 2000s or even late 1990s documents where Israel wanted regime change in all these different nations. And, of course, Iran's the final boss that they haven't actually taken out. But, you know, Iraq with Saddam, one of them, Gaddafi, Libya, Egypt, Syria, it's just like all these nations that so happen to have had some regime change in the last 10 years or even before that. And you have basically papers and documents from, you know, Zionists and Israeli lobbies that wanted this to happen.
Yeah. So.
And he doesn't bring that up, even though he could have.
And the other thing.
He could have brought it up.
To bring up is that everything that benefits Israel's interests in the Middle East seems to also come at the expense of Christians in the Middle East. So obviously a weakened Egypt, Arab Spring, go back to the Arab Spring. Egypt was the first to fall. Was it Hosni Mubarak was the leader of Egypt at the time?
I don't know his first name.
Hosni or something. He was ousted in a popular uprising, supposedly popular uprising because, Egypt's government building is right next to a ghetto. Yeah, so you can't really can't be an effective country like that.
Egypt kind of is a giant ghetto.
It is. It's a very dystopian looking country, but that's what Islam and communism do to architecture. But so Egypt fell. That was pretty good for Israel, but pretty bad for the Christians in the meantime, because you had a terrorist, Muslim Brotherhood dude take over Egypt for a couple of years, I think. Can't remember his name.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
But he got ousted by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, SCAF. So they have like a little bit of a military oligarchy in Egypt with a presidential figurehead, I think is kind of how their government works. And then, they wanted to go after Syria and Assad. Then they went after Libya. So all these, regional rivals, regional powers of Israel, if you could call them really rivals, Syria always has been, but Syria's also been very pacified for they don't stand a chance against the Israeli military. They just don't. And even after Assad had, even during the Assad and the Syrian civil war, he consolidated his forces, had to fight the terrorists like ISIS. Israel's still bombing the crap out of like Assad's military and committing acts of war against Syria very regularly. So, you're right that Iran's but all this was bad for the Christians in the Middle East. So Israel definitely played some sort of role in the fall of the Assad regime, which again, Assad was a very secular, Shia Islam, I think, or he was like a minority sect of that. And that he was tolerant of Christians, Saddam Hussein was a little bit more tolerant of Christians.
No, Saddam Hussein was very much like a secular nationalist type figure. He was not a hardcore Islamist, which is why it's kind of like the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And Syria, Egypt, and Iraq all had more or less secular dictators.
Yeah. I mean, secular dictatorship is the best you can hope for in the Middle East at the time, or at current. And another thing to bring up, Israel's constant bombing of Lebanon. I'm sure that's doing wonders for the Christian community in Lebanon, which is the most Christian country remaining in the Middle East.
Well, and they've also decimated that population by pushing a lot of Palestinians north into Lebanon back in the, I think, 80s or 70s and 80s. Yeah.
And I hate hearing, Israel is the only Middle Eastern country with a rising Christian population. It's like, okay, so you went from 1.7% to 1.8%.
And I don't even know if that's true, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if the former claim is true, but Israel's Christian population's like under 1% or under 2%, right? It's under 2%. It's the lowest of its neighbors. Even Jordan has a higher Christian percentage population than Israel does. So, I mean, it might amount to more Christians in Israel because of the population difference, but I was kind of shocked that Israel had a lower percentage of Christians than Jordan did. So, and of course, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the Azerbaijan-Armenian conflict, where Israel is backing the Azeris. as they ethnically cleanse Armenian Christians from disputed territory. And this also ties into the Iran thing, because that was definitely a country that they were using as a staging post for Iran and drone operations in Iran. So the Israeli government was giving the Azeri government drones and military weapons to attack Christians in Armenia and disputed territory. So, yeah, let me know when Israeli foreign Israeli ambitions have ever been good for Christians in anywhere, first of all, but in the Middle East specifically. Because, again, at the start, you know, going back to the whole claim of, oh, Israel's the only country with the rising Christian population. Yeah, it was about 16% Christian when in 1936. So that's in the middle of the British Mandate. And the data going back that time, you know, kind of skips some decades. So it's not like it's a year by year tracking. So I don't remember, you know, it was at it peaked at 16% under the British Mandate. It's been decimated ever since. So we got to have some historic perspective when we say, oh, Christian populations in the Middle East. Well, percentage-wise, it used to be a lot higher. And Lebanon used to be more so 50% Christian, I believe. So I'm ready to go to the next clip. So...
so you still haven't asked why, but I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
And the reason is twofold. Number one, as a Christian, growing up in Sunday school, I was taught from the Bible, those who bless Israel will be blessed, and those who curse Israel will be cursed. And from my perspective, I want to be on the blessing side of things.
Of the those who bless the government of Israel?
Those who bless Israel is what it says. It doesn't say the government of, it says the nation of Israel. So that's in the Bible. As a Christian, I believe that.
Where is that?
I can find it to you. I don't have the scripture off the tip of my... You pull out the phone and use the Google.
It's in Genesis. But so you're quoting a Bible phrase. You don't have context for it. And you don't know where in the Bible it is, but that's like your theology? I'm confused. What does that even mean?
Tucker.
I'm a Christian. I want to know what you're talking about.
Okay. Where does my support for Israel come from? Number one, because biblically we're commanded to support Israel. But number two...
Well, hold on. Hold on. You're a senator, and now you're throwing out theology, and I am a Christian, and I am allowed to weigh in on this. We are commanded as Christians to support the government of Israel?
We are commanded to support Israel. And
what does that mean, Israel?
We're told those who bless Israel will be blessed.
But hold on. Define Israel. This is important. Are you kidding? This is a majority Christian country.
Define Israel? Do you not know what Israel is? That would be the country you've asked like 49 questions about.
So that's what... That's what God is talking about.
The nation of Israel, yes.
Is that the current borders, the current leadership? He's talking about the political entity called Israel?
He's talking about the nation of Israel. Yeah, nations exist, and he's discussing a nation. A nation was the people of Israel.
Is the nation the God's referring to in Genesis, is that the same as the country run by Benjamin Netanyahu right
yes.
now?
Yes, yes.
It is. Okay.
And by the way, it's not run by Benjamin Netanyahu as a dictator.
I got to pause there because, yeah, that part just gets into a very... just silly topic, but what are your thoughts on that whole clip? Because I know I have a lot to say about that, but...
I mean, where do we begin? But let's just first start off by saying Ted Cruz interprets the statement in Genesis 12 to mean just a nation of Israel, but he conceives of it as like a modern nation state as we commonly perceive nations today. And then he anachronistically superimposes that into the past thousands of years. So he's basically saying the Old Testament nation of state of Israel is the same as the nation state of Israel today, which is kind of a ridiculous anachronism for multiple reasons. But I mean, it's different government, different people. I mean, a lot of genetic, let's just say variance between them, or genetic discontinuity would be a better way to state it. But he's not even referring to that verse as like the global like Jewish population, which is generally how it's commonly used by dispensationalists, where, you know, they would say that, you know, we protect the synagogue because they're God's chosen people and so forth. So they would apply verses like that to Jews globally, not just one nation state in the Middle East that bears the name Israel.
I think he does apply it to Jews globally, but he also again, there's so much to unpack here. Who are the descendants of Abraham, which I don't think Ashkenazi Jews are? I think the genetics, you do the 23andMe test, you're going to find out that there's not a whole lot of Abraham in there. But Palestinian Christians do seem to have the highest rates, other than like Samaritans and some other very close Christian populations to the area. So with that said, when he talks about Genesis 12, and clearly he's not an expert on that passage,
which you can't even cite.
Yeah. Let's just be real. When it says, God, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, that's kind of a thing about nations. But here's the thing. It's easy to, I can look at Israel and say, yeah, I can see how nations that came up against Israel have been cursed. But show me the nations that have been blessed by blessing Israel. And believe me, I don't see how America gives them, according to Ted Cruz in this interview, $3 billion a year, which is a lot of money. $3 billion a year. How is that not blessing Israel? How is that not blessing Israel to give them $3 billion a year? And where are the blessings in result? I posted that on the social media sphere last night. Still haven't gotten a positive answer. I got a lot of people saying, negative answers. But here's the thing. America's been on terminal decline. I don't think it's because of the state of Israel in 1947, but, it is a correlation. I don't think it's the only contributing factor. Well, I'm not going to do the whole causation fallacy, but it's not always a fallacy.
We look at a lot of the revolutions of the 60s, obviously they were, there's a disproportionate population of certain Americans that were involved in that, which, correlates with the, same population of Israel. So there is a population, every ism, but, Nazism is, promoted by Jews, yes. As Dennis Prager famously say.
It is.
So there is that Juneteenth. Correlation.
It is Juneteenth, the anniversary of two Jews who were executed by the United States government for espionage. That's the only time we've ever executed people for spying before. Just saying that, the anniversary of that is June 19th. So that's what we celebrate on this holiday, right? But anyway, bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. That does not hold up when you actually say, hey, where are the blessings? And oftentimes, this is used as a prosperity gospel. This is how John Hagee teaches a tribute theology. It's probably more so a tribute theology than it is a dual covenant theology, but I do think dual covenant theology is actually much better than what John Hagee preaches, which is more so a tribute theology that Christians need to pay tribute to Jews. So that is, I think that's the danger in what Ted Cruz says, but it's dangerous theology because of the consequences that it has on the United States, the Middle East, and also really the church at large. Because imagine if this energy were directed on a positive cause. Like, imagine if we took all our energy on Israel and on the Jews and spent it on evangelizing our populations here.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of, money that goes to, missions and stuff, or even a lot of these, ministries that are, help the Jews, Christians and Jews working together to help Jews, which, people like Mike Huckabee are kind of like spokespersons for.
They love advertising on Evangelical Dark Web, the website. You see the Google ads. They buy all the Google ads for, not all of them, but they buy a lot of Google ads for Evangelical Dark Web. It's like one for Israel or whatever. It's very ironic. Several people have pointed this out, but I don't mind taking their money because why not? They're not going to get a return on that if they, from my perspective, and I can't really control it, or I don't feel like controlling it. So anyway, because Google AdSense is like the least, it's one of the worst things to it's the least lucrative thing about evangelical dark web, probably, because it just doesn't pay.
But yeah, you have that. But then again, if you focus on a lot of the in-kind contributions of, you know, taking out Saddam Hussein, which, you know, we received the intelligence and a lot of the, I guess, the saber rattling came from one Benjamin Netanyahu. And you kind of get the fact is that actually accelerated our decline, is these Middle Eastern wars that did nothing. They weakened our, I guess, our image and prestige of the U.S. military by losing, more or less losing, two conflicts and having two boondoggles in the Middle East. So our image as a, in our ability to project power on a global stage, was weakened as a result of these wars.
Yeah. You know what's ironic, though? If you want peace in the Middle East, the irony is Iran having a nuke would probably be a sooner solution for that, just because you would do something. It's balance of power theory, which, you know, until World War One was actually kind of good at keeping Europe out of war, was everyone was all in these alliances, and that kept the balance of power, so they didn't fight each other because of that balance of power, you know. But Israel is just able to kind of punch everybody, and there's no balance to that. So Iran having a nuclear weapon would actually create a balance of power and would probably lead to more peace in the Middle East, because if two people are armed, they're not going to just start fighting each other for no reason.
So, I mean, it's, again, Iran's similar to North Korea in that regard, where they don't necessarily, they're not actually going to use the nuke on Israel. And just as Israel has not actually used a nuke on Iran, despite a lot of the rhetoric being very existential in nature. And by having a nuke, it just basically prevents interventionist regime change from being forced upon them. And yes. Yeah. And again, people will cite the Ayatollah, but he's 86 years old. He could die in the next year. He could die before they are actually able to obtain a weapon that is capable of being used.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So, is like, are they 3 weeks away from a nuke, or have they not actually been trying to get a nuke? Because in any case, I view the Iranian government as kind of incompetent. Because here I am thinking they've probably had a nuke for a while, because you can't be 3 weeks away from a nuke for 20 years. So either they've had a nuke for a while, or they're not actually trying to get a nuclear weapon. Because you can't just perpetually be 3 weeks away from a nuke for 20 years. That doesn't make sense. And that's incompetent. Like, honestly, the Iranian government would be incompetent to not, and probably is incompetent, because I might lean towards they don't actually have a nuclear weapon. That would be a sheer sign of incompetence on their part, because you know that the only way to prevent regime change, that's what history tells us, the only way to prevent regime change is to have a nuclear weapon. And that's kind of Iran's problem, is they don't want to be a junior partner to Russia and probably also China by extension. They don't want to be a junior partner. They want to be the big boy in the relationship, but they are not doing big boy things.
Well, my understanding in looking at like Russia and Iran's relationship is Russia stopped just short of invoking like an Article 5 style, like Article 5 of NATO style treaty
yeah, because they had Iran.
They did everything but that. And that's where it stopped short. They're not willing to sign a formal defense pact, but they're willing to do everything short of that. And a lot of that, I think Iran's government received a lot of criticism for being very much, I guess they were, you know, bending the knee to Vladimir Putin in the negotiations. So they kind of want it a little bit more than Putin wants it.
Yeah. And it's a weird relationship that they have that I don't think people like, oh, all these nations get together. I mean, Russia and North Korea apparently have a military alliance, because North Korea did send troops to the Kursk region of Russia. I don't know if they've actually entered Ukraine, but they were in the Kursk region. And we know that not because they look Asian, it's because the North Koreans fight differently than the Russians do. It's the tactics that, you know, say, hey, these are North Koreans and not Russians. So, but Iran's like, their tactics are going to be, you know, we're going to entrench ourselves, use drones and missiles and stuff like that. They're not going to fight an air war, because Israel has a very good air force, and they And they kind of always have since at least 1967, they've had a very good Air Force. So anyway, Ted Cruz can't explain the blessings, and he's about to get caught on the Genesis 12 nonsense.
Dictator. It's a Democratic country that elected.
He's the prime minister.
Right.
What?
But just like, you know, America is the country run by Donald Trump. No, actually, the American people elected Donald Trump. Same principle
is
there.
Silly. I'm talking about the political entity of modern Israel.
Yes. And that is
you
that is
believe
Israel.
That's what God was talking about in Genesis.
I do. But
that country's existed since when?
For thousands of years. Now, there was a time when it didn't exist and then it was recreated just over 70 years ago.
But I'm saying, I think most people understand that line in Genesis to refer to the Jewish people, God's chosen people.
That's not what it says.
Okay, Israel. But you don't even know where in the Bible it is. So
I don't remember the scriptural citation. But, okay, I keep...
It's like Genesis 16 or something like that. But yes, it's in the earlier part of the book. But the point is...
All right, Tucker, you keep interrupting me before I finish my sentence.
No, it's just important to know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're... So you're saying as a Christian, if I believe in Jesus, I have to support the modern state of Israel?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm explaining for me what my vote...
He did, in fact, say that, didn't he?
I mean, he does use the language that we are commanded to.
Yeah, didn't he just say that we're commanded to support Israel?
So
I support Israel because the Bible tells me so in Genesis somewhere.
Yes, he does make that argument and then says, well, not you personally, but at the same, he kind of maybe is walking that back. But at the same time, it is just a ridiculous argument to say that it is strictly the nation state of Israel as we commonly understand it today, superimposed for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean... The dispensationalists, like I have talked about this before, but I have a more preterist view of Old Testament prophecy. And the dispensationalists, they don't take yes for an answer when God answers a prophecy. They don't take yes.
Nope.
So going back to the exile, all these prophecies about return and regathering, they happened the 70 years after the exile. So they happen. And, you know, when they build a temple and build a wall, or they built the wall, then they built the temple.
There is, you know, Christological implication on, you know, the further gathering of the sheep being implicated in those prophecies. But yeah, in the immediate sense, it was referring to the return post-exile. And I highly doubt there's a first century Jew that would have interpreted it otherwise.
Yeah,
because they would have thought, oh, this is referring to, you know, our ancestors when they returned. They're being promised that they would return after the exile.
That's the most natural reading of the text. Then that's how Christians before 1947 would have read the text, most likely.
They also should kind of be noted that there's more Jews outside of Israel than within it. So they haven't all been gathered together.
Well, that's why 1947, 1948 wasn't good enough. That wasn't really the fulfillment yet because they haven't all regathered. Or when... the borders of Israel or the borders of what Abraham and his descendants are promised is laid out. It doesn't count because they didn't occupy all of these areas, even if they ruled over them, which I think if you rule over a place, that's as good as occupying it. That's how I view it. So they don't take yes for an answer when it comes to the Bible and the biblical events. And I guess that you have to not take yes for an answer if you insist on everything being futurist, but the stuff happens in the Bible. Stuff happens.
So,
and they say Israel counts now because they were sovereign, but Judea was a more or less sovereign kingdom for about 100 years, give or take. They were at times a client state of Rome and at times a client state of the Parthians and then back to Rome. But they were an independent sort of, you know, they had some independence in those 100 years. So they had independence and sovereignty already.
Now, again, in the article, I actually bring up Genesis 49:10, which is the scepter shall not depart from Judah, not a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Again, everyone interprets Shiloh to be Christ. This is even the Jewish interpretation that Shiloh is Messiah. And, you know, there's no ambiguity there. That is the interpretation of the text, because it directly signifies that the Messiah will come through Judah. And again, after Genesis, you know, going in Exodus and onward, Judah is the predominant tribe of Israel. There's really no contest there. So, but when it's saying the scepter is itself a symbol of sovereignty. It's a symbol of rule, even self-rule to some extent. And, you know, obviously it's saying that it will be, there will be unbroken sovereignty until Shiloh comes, which is Christ. And again, yeah, there were varying degrees of sovereignty with regards to the tribe of Judah being, you know, whether it was just elder rule, whether they had judges, or whether obviously the Davidic line would be the most prestigious form of the line, but it was still unbroken until Christ. And again, this is how the verse has been interpreted. So when Christ came, they lost their right to sovereignty. They have no right of self-government, so to speak, not any divine right, because Christ is their king. And apart from Christ, they have no right to the land. They have no right to self-governments.
Sounds good. Going back to the interview.
Motivation is.
But you, okay, so I'm just trying to understand. You said God tells you to support the modern state of Israel in the Bible, in some place in the Bible that you heard about, but you don't know where it is. That's your theology?
You're going back, am I a sleazy feline again? I mean,
if you accuse me of anti-Semitism again, I will say that, but I don't think you will.
Try to be a little less condescending. I'm trying to have
you're
a conversation.
You're condescending. You're throwing this stuff out, and it's my job to figure out what you're talking about, okay, but, and I don't understand.
But you're not letting me.
Okay. I'm sorry. I want to be polite.
That is, for me, a personal motivation, but I also, what I was about to say, I don't believe my personal faith, not everyone who I represent is a Christian, it's not an argument for me to give that we should do this because of my faith. And so as an elected official, I don't give that as the reason we should support Israel. That is a personal motivation for me, but I don't think it is the reason we should. The reason that I am the leading defender of Israel is because Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East, an incredibly troubled part of the world. And
so can I just say he's making the same argument that all the people are like, oh, I'm personally pro-life, but public policy-wise, like, that's such weak sauce that needs to get out of here.
Now, keep in mind, this is what he would argue the blessing from Israel is that they're waging a war with Iran to prevent them from being a nuclear power, which is in their own self-interest, not necessarily really relevant.
Not
to
in America's self-interest, but yeah.
Because again, it doesn't, them having a bomb doesn't necessarily affect trade routes and oil flow. And
not necessarily.
He's basically saying that them doing all this work for us is them blessing us, even though we will eventually have to pay for it, and they want us to basically financially and
militarily. Yeah, but we did
militarily
the legwork for most of it. You know, taking out Saddam was legwork that we did. I mean, I don't think the argument holds up.
No, but that is his argument of what the blessing we receive from them is.
Supporting Israel benefits America. And the clearest illustration of that is what is happening right now. Let me just make this point, and then...
Okay,
and then
I'll just ask what you mean. That's it. Okay. Yeah.
Look, Iran, I think the most acute national security threat facing America right now is the threat of a nuclear Iran. I think China is the biggest long-term threat, but acute and near-term is a nuclear Iran.
Okay.
And I think Israel is doing a massive favor to America right now by trying to take out Iran's nuclear capacity. And the reason I view Iran differently. We talked before about Iraq. I opposed the Iraq war. We talked about Syria. I opposed military intervention in Syria. The reason for that is those did not pose a threat to the United States. I think Iran is markedly different. Number one, the Ayatollah is a religious zealot. He is a lunatic, but a particularly dangerous kind of lunatic, because he's driven by religious fervor. When he says death to America and death to Israel, I believe him. And I think Iran is trying to get a nuclear weapon because there is a very real possibility they would use a nuclear weapon. So you want to ask, how does supporting Israel benefit us? Right now, this tiny little country, the size of the state of New Jersey, is fighting our enemies for us and taking out their top military leadership and trying to take out their nuclear capacity. That makes America much safer.
So I guess he's the first person to really answer the question, like, what are the blessings of getting blessed? What does getting blessed by Israel look like?
It looks like Middle Eastern interventionism.
Yeah. Like, thanks, another regime change war? Because it's not about the nukes. And that's kind of the end of the clip that I wanted to share. It's not about the nukes. It's clearly about regime change. And that's what the interview is framed as. Like, he supports regime change. He's calling it a popular uprising.
Popular uprising of a nation that says death to America would just result in another group that says death to America rising to power.
I mean, what do you think a popular uprising would look like in the Iran when it's just people in Tehran, you know, women in Tehran taking off their hijabs? What you're really trying to say is we want a French Revolution style uprising in Iran.
We want, Persian women to do OnlyFans is what they're saying.
That is kind of what they're saying, which, would definitely be getting in bed with the Jews. because, who owns that site? But anyway, because that's what is going to happen because, okay, let's say there's a popular uprising and Tehran falls to some sort of popular rebel. Whatever comes out of that is not going to be necessarily accepted by the surrounding ruralities. And another thing to point out, in regards to the Middle East in general, is that Persia is always going to be a seat of power, I think. Just logically, yes. They're a little bit, the Iraqis are not martial people. They're not good at military stuff. But the Persians, they occasionally are. So
you have two nations in the Middle East that were on the ascendancy. One would be Iran, which, they're kind of teetering. But at the same time, it's because they have all this pressure mounted on them. The other is Turkey, which is on a huge fast track to being a regional power, which, a lot of these wars in the Middle East are doing nothing but empowering Turkey. And a smart geopolitical strategy would kind of pit Iran against Turkey, against Israel, against Saudi Arabia, and kind of have like this balance of power between the four different nations in the Middle East.
Right.
Because Turkey now basically has functional control over Syria and perhaps is getting a little bit more hands-on a little bit more influence over Lebanon. They're the rising power. And Israel can't really do anything to them because they're a NATO ally.
Right. And you're right about doing the balance of power. Also tied to that is the divide and conquer strategy. Because honestly, I don't want any country in the Middle East being powerful. But the problem is, I think we're creating a monster with modern Israel because they are kind of powerful, especially if you believe the rumors, the supposed operation, like Samson operation, where if they go down, they're going to nuke everyone else with them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so concerned about that because, how many nukes can you launch at once versus as soon as you launch it, then obviously someone's launching at you. But again, if they were truly concerned about Iran being a nuclear power in the next 3 weeks, why aren't you using yours? Because I don't necessarily think they believe their rhetoric as much.
That's one thing that is brought up in Tucker's interview is that he says, if Iran's actually currently trying to take out and assassinate President Donald Trump, why is that not our casus belli to go to war? Should be the number one reason on the list.
So regarding that, he cites, we received testimony in Congress regarding this, alleged assassination attempt to get from the Iranians the perpetrators I can't name. And again, I'm not sure I buy it. And, I want to say it was literally the Wall Street Journal in the last 2 weeks ran a story about how the Pentagon was fabricating like UFO evidence to basically, convince Congress to fund its ambitions. So it's not like the military and its various apparatuses have not sought to provoke congressional action through false testimony and deception. Why would this be any different?
So, yeah, and I guess the last thing is, like, the last thing from the interview, like, the interview ends on a note where, like, Ted Cruz has no self-accountability for his policies. And, you know, they end up talking about the Russia-Ukraine war, which, you know, Ted Cruz came out hard supporting Zelensky in Ukraine and really has no grounds for an about face on that. So anyway, I don't know how much more I want to talk about this because I don't want this video to go on forever, but suffice to say, like, I'm going to throw a question at you before we go to the people. What do you think? Do you think this interview, which was seen by there are so many posts related to this interview that had millions of views on social media. So it's been a while since I've seen one interview be this viral. Do you think this was really bad? Was a bad time, a bad day for dispensationalism?
Think dispensationalism as a theology is dying. And obviously, one thing to note is that the boomers will be 50% mortality by 2026. So you're going to have a huge...
Really?
Yes. The early boomers will be 50% mortality. So it is a dying eschatology, but at the same time, it's dying, but it's still kind of in the, you know, still got the tentacles in the...
I mean, I saw a survey that considered... And I was considering writing about this. It considered anything older than 1964 to be the silent generation. Like, really? That's not what we call that. But is it just like people born before 1964 onward? Like,
well, generally, pre-boomers is called the silent generation.
I know that. But it's like, are they included in that too? Like, that's an insane stat to me because... I don't think boomers are even like 80 years old yet. So anyway, but it sounds like what you're saying is 50% of them won't make it.
I'm saying it's dying, but at the same time,
I guess that's more reasonable because that's around the life expectancy of the United States. So maybe I'm being dumb for my disbelief on that one.
I mean, it is dying. It is on its way out, but it's still got a lot of tentacles.
Does this hasten it?
I think this is a last ditch effort to get us into a regime change war. They don't have any, like, the window is closing, and this is like the last effort that you can do against the final boss that you haven't actually done a regime change on. This is their battle of the bulge, where they're trying to essentially, you know, not to use a World War II metaphor, but, you know, this is the we're trying to attack the center and break the line and basically make a path to the
Antwerp.
The English Channel in Denmark or the Netherlands.
No, it's Belgium or Antwerp because of the supply line.
So we're trying to break through in this final push. And, you know, when the enemy is most defeated is when they're most dangerous. And that's kind of what you're seeing now. They don't have anything else. They don't have any more stops that they can pull out. And they're pulling out everything they have to get this done.
Yeah, let me put a finer point on what you said, because you're right. Israel's acting because they have a time constraint, because Zionism in America is peaked. It has lost the next generation. Republicans under 40 or something? We talked about this 1 week, I believe. It was like Republicans under a certain age, which that age, I believe, was like...
I think it's 50.
There's a little bit, under 50, have a negative view of Israel. Majority of Republicans under 50 have a negative view of Israel. That means that means Zionism is dead. Israel only has a limited amount of time to pull off a regime change war that's in its interest. They have only a limited amount of time to use the United States for as its puppet, I guess. As its puppet might not be the right word. Let's say that Israel's the drunk girlfriend picking fights with someone at a bar that's like 300 pounds and ripped. Maybe 300 is a little high. Let's say, you know, they're picking the bodybuilder. It's like that has practical, you know, the UFC fighters are trying to just pick fight, you know, get us into fights that they can't win on their own, obviously. And that's what Israel has kind of been for the United States, that, you know, drunk girlfriend at the bar. So, Yeah, they only have a limited amount of time before the breakup comes. It's not a World War II metaphor where they're, you know, they're the H-man.
I mean, I could...
It's anti-Semitic to compare them, you know.
I mean, I could compare it to Pickett's charge. But obviously, if you're assuming there was no, you know, Union soldiers at the end of Pickett's charge, which is what they were anticipating. But yeah, if they can successfully break the line through, then, you know, they can get us into this war. And so it will be very disastrous, especially if we have to do regime change.
We have a super chat for $6.99 Canadian dollars. That ask about Ezekiel 22. So I have that pulled up, but I was not... again, I'm stuck in Judges, I believe, is in my reading. So it's going to be a while before I get to Ezekiel. But here we go. And it says, therefore, thus says the Lord, because of you have become dross, because all of you have become dross, therefore I'm going to gather you in the midst of Jerusalem. And as they gather silver and bronze and iron and lead and tin and into the furnace to blow fire on it in order to melt it, so I will gather you in my anger and in my wrath, and I will lay you there and melt you. I will gather you and blow on you with the fire of my wrath, and you will be melted in the midst of it, as silver is melted in the furnace, so you will be melted in the midst of it, and you will know that I, the Lord, have poured out my wrath on you. So we're being asked whether we think this was fulfilled already. So in this person, it's future and parallel.
I mean, I would certainly say that there's, yeah, a little bit of a both and, because obviously in the immediate sense, this is referring to the regathering after the exile. The metallurgical language is denoting, you know, refinement of the metal. So it's purifying, which again does apply to how the Holy Spirit purifies us. So I think that there is a both and, but I think it just refers to the church in a general sense, not necessarily eschatological in particular.
I do want to say also, this could be a biblical prophecy that probably has multiple fulfillments, hence it being echoed in Revelation 18. I'll take your word for that instead of, for the sake of time and not getting into that. But, you know, because obviously it could be a reference to Babylonian exile. It could also be a reference to AD 70, because the Romans, they absolutely went brick by brick and melted everything they could.
Yeah, so, they sifted the temple.
Yeah, so also seems very similar to that. I don't know enough about the siege of Jerusalem 586 off the top of my head. So that's a good question. Really gets people thinking. Are these the children of Onan? Like what? I don't even want to know what that's supposed to mean. So any other questions before we head out? So I'll do a last call for questions. But if you like the Evangelical Dark Web, you can support our content. By the least you can do is subscribe to the channel, to the podcast, if you are new. But other than that, we have a free newsletter. Check that out. And we also have a Patreon-like system that you can support, get access to bonus content, and among other things. So, anyway, with no more questions, I guess I'll end it. So, have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.